Okay, we're not going to take another break. We go to paper number 9.
Okay, thank you. Good morning again, everybody. This morning we're looking at agenda papers 9 through 9B, which are part of the research project for rate-regulated activities. These papers are part of the work that we're doing to develop a discussion paper on rate-regulated activities, where we're trying to explore whether the features of rate regulation distinguish rate-regulated activities from other general commercial activities, and whether there is anything about any distinguishing features that might require additional accounting guidance to be developed. When we started this project last year, we were looking at different types of rate regulation, and we issued a request for information that suggested that there were so many different types of rate regulation and lots of variations along the spectrum that we needed to find an approach that we could filter down information so that we could focus our work and actually make the project more manageable. And in September, we looked at some of the common features of rate regulation that we've identified through the request for information and through discussions with our consultative group that we felt were worthwhile focusing our work on in terms of developing the discussion paper and analysing these particular features. In this session, paper 9A takes those features that we discussed in September a step further and tries to identify the rights and obligations that are created by those particular features, if any, and tries to identify whether those rights and obligations are unique to rate regulation or would be found commonly elsewhere. From those, we've identified one particular feature that we think is quite distinctive, and that is what we're calling, for the purpose of paper 9A, a dual element adjustment. I'll apologise for introducing some terminology like that, but I wanted to distinguish two different types of adjustments that are commonly seen in rate regulatory regimes. One type of adjustment is that what we're calling the single element in paper 9A, where the rate regulation sets the price based on budgets and forecasts for a regulatory period. If there are any variations from the cost base or any other elements that affects the price, that isn't adjusted for retrospectively, but when it comes to setting the price for the next regulatory period, if any of those variations are expected to be permanent, then that will be reflected in the next period. However, there are other types of rate regulation that go a step further in, as well as looking at whether any past variations are likely to be permanent and building those into future rates, there's a second element to the adjustment which tries to reverse out the past variation. So it is a dual adjustment. One is prospective, the other is attempting to reverse out a retrospective variance. And the timing for that second element of the adjustment is often set within the rate regulation. So it's not a permanent adjustment to the price as the first adjustment is. It could be a short-term adjustment that lasts a few months or a few years. Paper 9B then goes a step further again and looks at whether the different features and the rights and obligations of those different features should be looked at as a complete package, or whether we can break down and disaggregate the package and pick out individual features that we think would benefit from a more detailed focus to try and progress the project and to develop the discussion paper. We didn't put any specific questions in paper A because it's so closely intertwined with paper B, and we do only have one question at the end of paper B, which is, do you agree that in developing the next stage of our analysis of rate regulation and whether we might need to develop specific accounting treatments or accounting guidance, whether this particular feature creates rights and obligations that might be recognised in financial statements, are you happy that for the time being we focus on that dual element type of feature as the main focus of our next stage of our analysis? But at that point, I'll just leave it open and you can ask any questions, raise any comments on papers A or B.
A or B, okay. Yeah. Fine. Any comments? Jungle.
Just one clarification. We are using, I mean, the meaning of dual element adjustment. So if we just do a progressive adjustment in one element,
yeah,
and a prospective adjustment, the two dual elements.
Yeah.
It's a quite simple meaning.
Yes, yeah. The one that we're focusing on is the dual element. We don't believe that the single element is sufficiently distinctive or unique that would warrant development.
Jane, where does that leave something like the adjustment for pensions? You know, where you've got the case where they only pay cash, it was not paid out in cash, and you accumulate the rest and you're hoping to get that all back in adjustment in the next 20 or 25 years. How does that fit into your philosophy?
I think with that one, and this would be part of the analysis to break this down into further detail and look at individual types of adjustments, but I think many of the ones that I've seen, it is a timing adjustment and the intention is that it will get reversed out in the future. So my initial reaction is that I think those, in a lot of cases, will be captured in the dual element.
But what do you mean by reverse out? Because my understanding would be you incur a pension expense of $1 million, but you only pay out cash of $100,000, so you've built $900,000 liability, and then the asset,
yeah,
a regulatory asset if we're going to have one, of $900,000, and then this builds and builds, and then gradually as people retire, you pay out more cash, and you'll reduce that.
Yeah.
But it's not, it doesn't exactly fit your model, does it?
And could you explain why it doesn't fit the model a little bit better?
Well, it's timing. But, I mean, it's my understanding in some situations, the regulator will just pay out for pensions, will take into account as a cost,
right,
those pensions which you've paid out in cash, and then the rest.
Yeah.
So I guess over a period of time, for a start-up operation, the gap will build and build and build, and then maybe level out, or depending how the business goes.
But are you saying it doesn't meet the dual characteristic approach that
we're
talking about in A? And I was wondering why, because if the regulator didn't see to it that they ultimately got the cash to pay those pensions, then the company would have to declare bankruptcy, and the service would no longer be provided to the customers. So it's in the protection side.
Well, I think this is a personal view. I'm quite worried about this adjustment economically, because I think it will build out of control by not allowing an expense as it's incurred, but just paying the cash. I think it'll get to the point where you can't adjust prices to cover it because it's too big.
Well, that's a regulatory problem,
sure,
and an impairment problem.
Sure.
But I don't think it says it doesn't meet the model. It's just a question about whether the regulators are competent and control it. I mean, the other part of the equation is the regulator should be seeing to it that the pension benefits offered to the employees are something that they can bill the customers, can afford eventually. I mean, that's the other part of the assumption, that the regulators are looking at the cost being incurred and controlling it.
My point was very much in the point of the question, really.
I think I
didn't understand why you didn't think it fit the model.
I think it's sort of building in several issues at the same time, and I think pensions will be an area that we will need to look at very carefully, in partly because it is such a long-term thing. And Ian's point is very valid about, you know, can they actually recover? But I think I'm seeing this as a step-by-step approach, and can we focus on this feature as a way to control the project so we've got something definitive to work on, and then we can think about recognition and measurement and impairment as we go along.
Okay, Gary?
Just a couple of unrelated questions, at least unrelated to each other. And by the way, I sort of like where you are on that. The dual adjustment approach, is that supported by the working group on this, or is this something we can, it makes sense to me, but just the origins of
The working group, we've got a meeting in 2 weeks' time, and the papers that we're looking at today, we're going to do some more testing with the working group to make sure that it is a working assumption that this is a model that's common enough that makes doing the analysis worthwhile. Our initial discussions with the working group, paper 9B kind of developed from some of those early discussions, but we haven't then gone back to the working group to test these. We're going to do that in a couple of weeks' time.
Can I ask you, Lou, on the unit account, we have a dilemma. If in environment or particular, entity, the regulatory decision is clearly on individual basis, transaction or asset, and cost and recovery is so clear, they're relatively, for us, easier to justify whether liability and asset exist. But now, since more and more move to flexible schemes, and the company become much more bigger, and it becomes relatively hard. So we have to take into consideration all the regulatory decision, or the regulatory decision is based on effect. Then it will be relatively difficult to say there is a separately identifiable and measurable asset or liability. And therefore, we may have to consider whether we should regard it as a separate intangible asset or addition to the license. I'm right that this is a dilemma.
That's the dilemma, yeah, and that's what we tried to bring out in paper B. There are alternative ways of looking at it. You can say that it is part of the overall license to operate in that particular industry. And paper 9B, we tried to explain that yes, that is a valid viewpoint, but I'm not sure it helps us to progress the project. And what I would like to do is to be able to break it down into a smaller component so that we can do an analysis on that basis. Not to dismiss completely taking it as part of the bigger package, but just to allow us to progress the discussion paper, and we can include a discussion then as to whether we bring it back into the license at a higher level of aggregation. But I'm just finding it very difficult at this stage to be able to do a clear analysis by looking at the entire package as the whole license. I'm struggling to see how we can take that forward, because there's too much to deal with, and I'm just trying to filter down what we're dealing with to make it manageable to allow us to progress.
But on the other hand, whether this will result in, firstly, it's not real, because you try to isolate, but in reality, not isolate. And secondly, will result in some very narrow scope. The entities or transactions, we will finally say it's qualified. But people say, the final conclusion makes no sense, because it's not real.
Yeah, and that's why we do want to test it with the consultative group. Like I say, I'm working on my initial observations and my understanding of the regulation. I think this dual element approach is common to a very wide range of companies and entities. The amount of transactions that get captured by it is narrower. So there are some schemes that are very close to the pure cost of service type scheme, where the dual adjustment applies to a wide variety of costs, if not all of the costs. In other schemes that are much more towards the incentive extreme, it may only be one particular type of cost that gets captured by the dual element type of adjustment. So it may be fuel costs is a common example. So I think one of the reasons that I'm attracted to using this as a focus is that it gives us a big enough population of entities that we can get a flavour that if this is an issue, then it's going to be a big enough population to make it worthwhile dealing with it without exploding out the project to capture a myriad of different things that perhaps we don't want to capture.
Mary?
Let me start with just a basic confirmation of my understanding. If you look at paper 9A, the very last paragraph of that paper, sub-item G in the appendix, the that's what you mean by the dual adjustment model, something that meets those two criteria.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I thought, but just putting that front and center, wanted to check that. A few thoughts and observations. No disagreement with what you know. Thinking about a discussion paper, I think you're right to say what's a manageable scope of the project, and if based on the research you've done, you think the dual adjustment is the best candidate, then let's identify that and explore it. It struck me as I looked through here that I think a real stress point will be, and I think we not only have to put it front and center, but give us, ask enough questions and do enough exploration to have a basis to move forward, is whether one alone is enough. And that's not getting into the is it then an adjustment of the license, but will people say, if I'm required to collect variance accounts because we will discuss with the regulator whether or not I can recapture those in future periods, shouldn't that be enough? I don't have to have the second aspect. I think we really want to hash that out early on, because that was the one that seemed to me to be the closest. Then the second thing in terms of structure is, if we focus it on this, I think we should do some of what you've done in this paper 9A, which is to identify the criteria that aren't enough. Here are all the things we considered, and be explicit that we're saying we think these are not distinguishing features that would get you into a special rate-regulated model, if any. Because I think if we just focus on these but don't bring out those others, they'll be kicking in the system and coming up at the last minute. I agree with the point that unit of account will probably need some exploration. Based on what you said, though, switching yet again in response to Wigwell, I think maybe just saying there may be a class of items that fall outside rate regulation. Once we figure, once we are final or near to final on this project, we will then consider whether to go back and look at IS-38 intangibles and licenses and what the action is. Just say, this is what we're going to do, but we're not going to do it in this project, so don't suggest it as an add-on to this because we think the project will be unmanageable. But
don't give an undertaking that we will do it either.
No, but just say that's a separate question that we'll look at after we finish this to see whether it's worth exploring that or not, and just so it's clearly identified as another project. And last two things is in 9A you commented about, I think it was 9A, price flexibility.
Yeah.
And paragraph 23. I think we shouldn't give, my comments about this is I think that real price flexibility in terms of there may be a cap, and we discussed, this is an issue that came up when we were discussing the interim project. I think it just gets to whether or not there is in substance rather than in form price regulation, because if there's only a cap and all the competition is driving the price substantially below, then all the variance accounts, et cetera, it may be compliance to prove that you're not overcharging.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it isn't. So I think I would actually deal with price adjustment as much, price flexibility at a much higher level, to say there has to be meaningful price regulation, rather than getting into details. And the very last, just to think about, 39, paper 9A, paragraph 39, you say that A, the obligation to maintain quality and supply of goods or services on a non-discriminatory basis supports the use of future sales prices as a practical basis for recovery. I just don't get that connection. So I don't get why. I understand that operators have an obligation to provide access and quality service. I also understand that in rate regulated, one of the ongoing arguments is we're an essential good, et cetera, et cetera. This is why we have a very high level of probability, and we have to keep saying it's not just probability. I just don't get the connection between the thought in A and the assertion in the leading paragraph. If you have an immediate reaction, welcome it, but if not, just think about, for preparing the paper, why, what the connection is there. I think there's just a point that maybe hasn't come through.
Yeah, I mean, I have to give an immediate reaction now. My thought process there was linked to the probability and the essential good. The rate regulator is trying to use the mechanism to make sure that these variances reverse out in the future. And it's just the stability of the demand, the stability of the supply, and making sure that there's a high level of predictability enables the regulators to use that mechanism rather than requiring.
And I understand all that, I just didn't see what its relationship was to the obligation that's imposed on the operator to maintain quality and supply of goods. I just understood everything you said.
Is it a quality issue rather than the...
I just didn't understand why this was part of ensuring recoverability, and I guess that's the last thing, is some of the things that you just cited in your response, essential good, exclusive or near exclusive, that all go to the probability of recovery. Will we be talking about those in the discussion paper or not as characteristics that, in addition to the dual adjustment model, are necessary?
I think my thought is that in the discussion paper, yeah, we're asking questions whether these are essential characteristics or optional characteristics, that if they don't exist, it doesn't stop you from being captured, but it just raises more questions.
So it's almost like we have three buckets. You're saying dual adjustment necessary, other things often present but not relevant, and some that we think may raise questions about, you know, a middle category, like essential good,
yeah,
et cetera. Because there are other things that you raised in the paper as we often find present, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I'm not a big bucket fan, but I appreciate that shorthand for, it's okay, it's just that, you know, I get shivers thinking about impairments and buckets now, so it's closely associated with it. But yeah, that's the way I see this progressing, but obviously it's early stages and it may move. But yeah, my initial thought from this work so far is that I think the dual element will probably end up being as an essential feature. The others, it's open to debate, and I'm sure it'll become clearer as we start to do more work and discuss whether they become essential features or just supporting features.
Okay, Tech.
Yes, I just want to test whether I understand the purpose of the dual meaning. The big challenge of this research is whether or not we have assets. One, that is the point. So then, and you picked up something about you compared with the internally generated goodwill. And I find there is some similarity between internally generated goodwill and regulated assets. The common feature of those two types of assets is that we cannot identify who owes the liability. Because in the case of internal generated goodwill, nobody has a liability. Then the regulated assets, whether there is anybody who owes liability. I don't think there is no one who clearly, explicitly owes the liability. However, the big difference between internally generated goodwill and rate-regulated assets, which we are going to create, is there may be some implicit person who may owe the liability. Perhaps that is the regulator. And they don't have a explicit liability, but in a sense, they are regulating those industries, and they, in a sense, guarantee the continuation of those industries. So therefore, they have such a liability. The other thing important is the difference is in the case of internally generated goodwill, nobody is actually, nobody external person has related. However, in the case of rate-regulated assets, there must be some intervention from the external side. So those two features are, you know, major big difference between internally generated goodwill and rate-regulated assets. So test is whether dual criteria clearly segregate those two or not. I think, in a sense, dual will work because you are trying to find out what is the real amount, which may be owed by government or regulator. So in this sense, I would like to support your direction. However, something I had a struggle with your paper was you used the word any bonus or penalty. Yeah, it's clear. It's easy to understand, to image what the dual second criteria means. But if you just simply say bonus or penalty, for those who don't have such a system, may think we would not be eligible. So perhaps I think you could make some improvement for these words.
Yeah, thanks, Pat. Interestingly, I was just rereading the paper just before coming into the meeting and realised on that point, perhaps I should say, and or a penalty or bonus, because it does read as an adjustment, which is the and the penalty or bonus. But you're right, some systems would just be the penalty or the bonus without the first part of the adjustment. Others would be just the first part without the penalty or the bonus.
But my point is not just and or, but the wording of bonus or penalty itself is quite, sounds like narrow.
Right, I see what you mean.
I just want to say that I agree with the directions proposed by the staff. However, on paper 9B, specifically on the unit of level of presentation or aggregation, I think you're right, trying to capture through this project the internally generated intangibles rather than goodwill would be quite difficult and would open up a series of questions about other intangibles for entities that would not fall in the scope of this project, that could be very near. They might not meet all the criteria, so they might be taken out of the scope, but they could be very, very closely in economic terms, very close to that, and then we would have to deal with the tangible. Otherwise, we would create a lack of a level playing field between different types of entities which could be very close to each other. Now, this being accepted that we have a limited scope of recognition of those assets and liabilities, I think a way to mitigate this is to have a good set of disclosures about the effect of the regime in terms of creating rights and creating obligations that are not recognized but should be disclosed very precisely.
Jane, actually, part of my question, I guess, was embedded in some of Philippe's observations, so these, I guess, questions for you, maybe you can confirm. I like him, am very supportive of the general direction you're going in, but I'm just trying to understand what the implications are for the measurement of a rate-regulated asset or liability is from paragraph 27 in paper 9B. I completely agree that the most significant component of this mechanism is this true-up adjustment, and you say it can take, it can be reflected in differences between estimated actual and either a bonus or penalty. That'll make sense. I guess my question is, how is that going to be measured, over what horizon, and what period? Because as Tak's observations and Philippe's observations lead me to conclude, you could do it one way, in the sense that you could make a forecast of expected cash flows, net cash flows, and book that. Or you could basically just come up with what you think is you know, for the next period, the amount you over accrued or under accrued, overpaid, you know, or you due back. There's a lot of different ways you can calculate this, and I'm just trying to understand how you're trying to do that, and at the same time deliver the most useful information to the reader about the rate-regulated nature of this entity. And when you talk about unit of account, I don't disagree separating, you know, the whole notion of the license is one thing versus the implications of the license, if you will. But one of the questions that have also has been raised in this area is whether or not you can look at the pool of customers that this entity is dealing with, both present and future, in the same way you would look at a pool of insureds if you're writing, you know, an insurance policy and trying to distinguish, you know, where the boundaries are. I'm just trying to get a sense where you're going with it in that regard.
It's a journey. If I could take your first question first, mm-hmm. which is the measurement issue, I think you're kind of a step ahead. I see this as the next step is talking about whether that adjustment could be classified as an asset or a liability. So that there are rights and obligations attached to the mechanism, but the next step is, does that actually create an asset or a liability? And if the conclusion is yes, then we think about what type of asset or liability and therefore how to measure it. And I'm glad you've come up with the questions you did, because it kind of reaffirms where I was thinking of maybe the December board meeting to talk about measurement, because I'm trying to stay a couple of steps ahead and think about where we're going with this project. So measurement, all of your issues and comments are absolutely valid, but I'm not in a position to answer them now because I haven't done the intermediate step. Have we got an asset or liability to measure? Which comes back to Philippe's point as well, in that if they are assets and liabilities, we can talk about recognition and measurement. If they're not assets and liabilities, we talk about whether it's just the disclosure route that we go or whether we need to do something different. So it is a very step by step.
I guess the implication then of that for me is I can't give you a definitive answer whether or not I think you're on the right path in terms of the unit of account. I just reserve, you know, my judgment on that. It may be or may not be. I guess until I see the entire measurement model, it's kind of hard to say. Yeah, I mean, in the context of insurance, for example, it makes eminent sense that the unit of account is something other than a single contract, right? Because no insurance company would write one or two contracts. The whole premise is it's built on the law of large numbers. And I kind of think that this has a similar aspect to it. You wouldn't build a power plant and provide electricity to just the people in this room, okay? The cost wouldn't justify that. So unit of account is critical here, and how you're measuring all the moving parts is critical as well, I think, to capturing the true economics of what's going on.
I don't know whether the terminology unit of account is the right terminology to use at this stage.
Possibly not. It's not the method, unit of account is the method for liver.
Yeah.
What liver is high to analyze the economy.
Yeah. I think unit of account maybe does imply that there's already a decision that there's an asset or liability to account for.
Okay,
and
all right.
We're not at that stage yet. But
fair enough.
Gary, did you want to come back?
Yeah. In your discussion paper, you think all these deferred assets and deferred liabilities. Are you going to ask what types are most common out there? Are we going to suggest what? Are we going to? Do you have a list of what they are? I mean, I can envision what they might be. Or are we just going to ask, you know, for this being our input?
I don't know. I mean, we've already got a list of some of these things. Ian's mentioned one already with the pension timing difference and other accounting timing differences. Storm costs is a really common example. The fuel costs. We've already got quite a list of things. But at this stage, I mean, I don't see the types of costs as being critical. I think it's the mechanism and how that impacts on future cash flows that's more important than what does it relate to.
Because typically, I think, you know, they disallow, you know, stuff where the accrual expensing or accrual is so far different from the cash flows, you know, so that's why typically you'll see pensions is a good example. You might get the funding, you know, contribution, but not the expense. Likewise, deferred taxes, long-term executive compensation accruals, capitalized interest, all these things are, at least my experience, are very typically adjustments in rate cases in there. So the but with that, you know, which I think one of the fundamental things in life, you would defer these things because you're going, your rate case will be more predicated on near-term cash flows. So we can ask the question, are we, is this really in packaged differently? There really is an extension of the matching concept because there's a lot of revenues. You know, that's what this is about, you know, in many respects.
I mean, I think the feeling that I'm going to, and I think it's reflected in the issue we talked about, the dual approach, with the bonus or the penalty, we're not just talking about deferred costs. We're talking about, effectively, it's an adjustment to the price that relates to future cash flows, but that adjustment is driven by things that have happened in
right.
the past,
yeah.
not necessarily just deferred costs.
I think it's a fundamental problem that we need to clear out very quickly. Is it about deferring costs or anticipating revenues, or is it about recognizing a quote-unquote receivable or quote-unquote payable that results from the mechanism that incorporates all sorts of elements? And I quote-unquote receivable, because I'm not sure we call it a receivable, or is it an intangible, or receivable, a special asset?
I think this is part of the confusion in the past. People have focused on it being deferral system, and the more I understand and the more I see about these mechanisms, it's not, to my opinion, just based on deferrals. It is looking at what's happening to the cash flows in the future. And I'm not clear whether that creates receivable or an intangible or what it actually creates, but that's part of the next step of the analysis.
Are you in your research, because we got all, I'll call it the supporting features that you listed, and to try to prioritize what's more important or learn more about, because there's a lot of rate-regulated stuff out there that might be essential, but it's not anywhere near a monopoly. Banks have rate, you know, insurance companies, but you've got choices. You know, you get choices in hospital rates. You know, you go walk-in clinic versus, you know, a five-star hospital. But to me, of the supporting ones, the monopoly or near monopoly franchise is the more important of your supporting ones, because most other cases you've got choices, or you've got, you know, for quality of service, there's consumer products commissions and stuff that, you know, can enforce that. So I don't know if you're going to try to prioritize them or flesh them out deeper, but
I think definitely fleshing them out deeper helps, because it comes back to Mary's earlier point on the bucket of essential versus near. Well, I'm not going to use near essential because we use it in a different context, but which of these features do we have to see? Which of them do we expect to see? And if they're not there, then it raises questions. Which ones do we normally see, but they're actually not that critical? But yeah, I think it's important to flesh those out.
Mary?
Coming back on, I can't remember, I think it was Chung Wu's question. I asked you, and you confirmed 9A, that very last paragraph, that this is what you meant by dual adjustment, and there's the and at the end of small one. And then if you look at paper 9B, in paragraph 27, I think it's a summarized version of that.
Yeah.
And it's and or. Are you just trying to... Given that we call it dual, or you're suggesting it gets called something like dual adjustment, it sounds like you must have both. And I think we have to be really clear about whether we're saying there are two possible sources of adjustments there, you know, and here are the two sources. Is either one enough, or do you have to have both? And is it really actually the fact that you have adjustments and you're just explaining what the two sources of them are most typically?
I think you're right, and I'll apologize, because I think I use slightly different summaries in different places, and the and and the all get confused. I think as part of our analysis, we'll answer the question whether you have to have both or whether it's just the second adjustment that's the crucial adjustment. My initial feeling is it is just the second adjustment, which is based on the past performance. The first adjustment is the one where we're saying you've had some variances in the past, if you expect those to stick, then you build it into your estimated price for the future because you think those costs are going to be there. That in itself, I doubt, would be a critical feature. I think that's just a normal feature of price setting in any sort of commercial environment. If your costs go up, you try and pass them on to the customer. So I'm not sure that the first of those at the end of paper 9A would be critical, and we'll probably end up, again, focusing on the second part of that, which is G2.
I find it interesting because early on you had, and we're still in very early stages in this, first reaction that you've had, and I think others of us kind of went, yeah, that feels right, is that it's the existence of variance accounts that is the distinguishing feature, and it seems like either A or B, but A in particular is the source of variance accounts, so I think we've got to bottom it out.
Yeah, you're right. My feeling at the moment is we're going beyond just simple variance accounts, which gets us into two.
Very good. I'm not sure whether you have already observed such a system. It's a hypothetical. Maybe if people follow that one, forget whether there's asset liability, forget measurement difficulties. Let's assume, you know, it's the easiest measure, and the key is whether we can isolate, as we discussed yesterday, the accounts which must follow our standards, and the ones which is not fully, but we isolate them. The reason why I ask is because, you know, for me, why I'm against is because you put the uncertainty and other reasons. And another reason is, you know, the regulatory decision will poison all of the accounts, assets, the PPE, intangibles, and others, and have to, you know, segregate. And I had one very interesting discussion with Steve Bell, and he said, I support. I said, why do you support Steve Bell? He said, I support a system like this. Assume a dam collapse. He said, you should recognize, as our standards required. So, recognize a lot. But, assume, you know, the measurement of the regulators approve you, then he says, I will allow you to debit an asset with deferred and credit expenses, which offset the debt loss. And he says, you know, if that is the case, it's very clear all the accounts were based on our standards. All the debit credit is not in line with our standards, but they're purely isolated.
Right.
Have you seen any such kind of system?
I'm not sure I fully understand the point, but so let me try and clarify. So are you talking about a system where if the dam collapses, the regulation says the company can recover the costs of repairing and recovering the dam? And so are you saying that the double entry would be just debit the regulatory assets and
credit expense.
So
and the loss of the dam is still recognized based on standards. The problem now is in many countries, you know, in some of the regulatory environments, the authority have a very detailed rule of account and will ask you to debit this, debt credit this, and they will poison all the accounts in all of the accounts, you know.
Do you want to answer first and then I'll come back?
I think that nothing we're talking about would preclude a system that Wego described. I think it's very early in our process.
Yeah,
as you explained before, we don't even know whether we have assets and liabilities yet, much less how we would recognize and derecognize them and display those in the comprehensive income statement. But I don't think that our constituents should either assume that if we do have assets and liabilities, it will look exactly like the system that they have today. In fact, they should probably assume it may not look like anything like the system they have today. And I would say that certainly something that you described would probably provide very useful information, because certainly if the dam is collapsed, it's not there anymore. But you do have, in a sense, a kind of receivable to replace one someday.
But the consequence of that, I think, is you'd end up with the dam being re-established at its original cost, not its new cost. Is that right? Because you're being reimbursed for it to fix it and remedy it.
Well, I don't think you put a dam on your balance sheet until you had a dam.
Well, no, you might have a dam first, okay? So your dam's on there at cost.
Right.
It now collapses.
Right. You have an expense because the dam is gone.
So that's the question was really whether you kept it in there and then you're paid to basically fix it again. So you leave a bit of money going out, it's coming back in, but from the government.
No, idea not pay money to fix.
Yeah.
Is why you look on that asset, because the regulator approve you to increase the future price.
Yes.
So you got the future price, and through allocating of that asset to match that price. All right. This is the key idea.
Well, I think you're way ahead of where we are at the moment. We'll come back and talk about it again, but it's going to be part of our process for taking this further and seeing where we end up. And that we'll have to discuss that as part of the later discussion.
Any further comments? Okay, that's going to be good. Thank you, Jane. Moving on to macro hedging, paper number 4.
We need people.
Yeah.